Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
Hey there, and welcome back to another Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined again today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Top of the morning, Josh.
Top of the morning to you.
So we have kind of a lot to talk about today.
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm looking at the clock already.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to have to, we're going to look at a few subjects, all of which we could probably spend a whole podcast on, and depending on what lingers and what doesn't,
yeah,
some of these subjects may or may not come back in more depth. And I say that if you're listening to this and you've been following the news, there's been a lot of churn, and there's even a couple of things that have happened that could have been added to this list,
yeah,
but I'm not going to go there. But what I thought we'd do is a little bit of a 2026 election news roundup. There have been a few big stories in the last few days, really. A big Democratic win over the weekend in the Senate District 9 special election in Tarrant County, and that special election was to replace the vacancy created by current and aspiring comptroller Kelly Hancock. On the other side of the ledger for Democrats, in the race for the Democratic nomination to the U.S. Senate between James Tallarico and Jasmine Crockett, the eruption of a fight over alleged racially insensitive comments made by Tallarico in regard to former candidate Colin Allred and Allred's response to that have been very much in the news. And then over in the Republican primary for that same U.S. Senate seat, Republican President Donald Trump tossed a big rock in the pond by announcing that in the wake of the SD9 results, and we might speculate on just how firm that connection was.
Right.
We'll set that aside. But certainly that in the wake of that race, this got a lot more attention. And that is, Trump made comments suggesting that he may in fact endorse one of the candidates in that dogfight on the Republican side.
Right.
I'm not calling them dogs. I'm characterizing the conflict.
Yeah.
All of this is sort of connected in interesting
mm-hmm.
ways.
Yeah.
I mean, in the sense that everything's connected maybe, but even a little more than that.
Yeah.
But it's also, as with the Trump SD9 linkage, some of these connections sometimes are a little more coincidental, I think, than
right.
actually connected. Or we have to keep in mind that some of the connections we might make are a little speculative.
Right. Or a lot speculative.
So
we'll try to be upfront about that as best as we can here.
I think that's fair.
We're not reporters, we're not journalists here. We're reading the tea leaves with everybody else, just with a lot more data usually. So that's about,
So let's start with SD9. The basics. Democrat and union leader Taylor Remmett won the special election Saturday to represent what is a solidly red Texas Senate district by most any measure.
Yeah.
We can talk about, I think, shifts in Tarrant County, but
that district hasn't shifted.
Is a red district.
Right.
And Remmett carried that race by 17 points.
No, 14 points. It was
14
Trump
points.
Carried it by 17 points.
Oh, that's right. It was a
Trump
17 district. Remmett wins by about 14.
Right, so 32-point swing if you do, and that doesn't sound right, but
yeah,
it is when you do the percentages.
Right, but a pretty big upset.
Yeah.
That injected a very fresh and urgent sense of a panic in the GOP, I think, from on the ground in Texas all the way against, perhaps. To the White House. As we work through the primary season, but also really the sense of panic has to do with anticipation of
right.
a midterm election that should favor Democrats. So what do we, talk a little bit more about what that race looked like.
Yeah, I mean, overall, just in terms of the votes we're looking at, one of the things we just have to say, and this is sort of set piece here, special elections are unique
yeah.
beasts, right? So, for example, there were about 90 95,000 votes cast. And if you look and you think about what's going to happen in the actual general election that's going to come up, which is going to see the same two candidates facing off against each other again, it's going to be probably closer to 250 to 300,000 votes. So you can multiply this out by at least, you know, two to three times, right, in terms of what we're going to see. But I mean, the main thing that sort of, I think everybody's focusing on is this has been such a solidly Republican district. And I think, you know, if you were paying attention really closely, like very closely, you know, in the last few weeks leading into that, there were a lot of grumblings here on the ground in Texas that like that race might be a little bit tighter than people thought.
Yeah.
You saw, I mean, one of the big pieces where we're kind of making some of these connections is, you know, the lieutenant governor spent a lot of money on this race. A lot of Republican groups spent a lot of money on this race. And what's notable within all of this is that, you know, at the end, there's sort of this notion of this huge spending advantage that Republicans had. But the scope of the loss was pretty big,
yeah,
given both, again, the nature of the district, by which I really mean just to be specific here, Republicans know where Republican voters live in this district. They know how to find them. They've communicated with them regularly. They've turned them out regularly. There was no lack of resources to do so. They just couldn't do it. And then further, you know, when we go and we start to look at some analyses, and we should have to, you know, we have to give the little hat tip here to our friend Ross Hunt. Ross is a longtime, you know, what would you call him? Consultant, I guess, right?
Yeah,
local
sure.
Consultant state. I mean, he's been working with the voter file, you know, since I started even working on Texas stuff. And so he's someone that, you know, I would say I trust, yeah, you know, the results of anything.
Before
that
we
done.
Go to, we should also just make sure we didn't mention, you know, the Republican candidate was a conservative activist.
Right.
You know, Lee Wamgans. I've never really quite figured out exactly how to say
Wamgans.
Wamgans.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people drop the N anyway. Themselves, you know, who themselves was a controversial pick.
Yeah.
You know, a relatively, I think it's fair to say, based on the campaign, relatively, and the candidate history, relatively far-right candidate and supported, as you said, by the lieutenant governor and the lieutenant governor's other assets, shall
yeah,
we say.
Yeah, and we'll swing back around to this, I think, maybe after, just because I'll ask you a question once I come back in with the data, because I think one of the pieces there also is, you know, if you've been following sort of, you know, local politics, I think this happens in other states too, although I don't know how many people are listening to out of state, but Wamsgans was in a lot of ways associated with a lot of school board takeovers in and
yes,
around the Fort Worth area. And these school board takeovers have been an interesting sort of political, you know, happening in and of themselves, because a lot of them were taking place in these sort of suburban parts of the state, which also happened to be some of the most competitive parts of the state. And so, you know, you have this big shift in kind of education policy in some of these communities. And at least if you go around, I mean, I've done some talks in some various places, this stuff comes up, you know, the school board stuff. And so that association may or may not, it may have been a problem, but this is the question I'll come back to. So the Ross Hunt analysis basically points out that if he looks at the electorate that turned out, you know, by his estimation, about 35% of the electorate was Democrats, about 14% was independents, which gets you to about 49% of the electorate.
Non-Republican
electorate. And then you've got 51% who seem to be, you know, reliable Republicans. So to Ross Hunt's point, all the Democrats had to vote for Remit, as well as all the independents, and no small number of Republicans in this case. And that raises the question of, well, what does that mean in the sense of, you know, was that a reaction to the ideological, you know, extremity potentially of the Republican candidate? Is that a lesson? Was it something else? You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm a little more leaning towards the big national kind of currents in my sort of analysis of what
yeah,
happened personally, but I don't know what you think, whether you think the on the ground stuff.
Well,
was...
I think this is one of those things we've been talking about over and over again, right? Where, you know, there's certainly a national atmospherics
right,
are at work here. Certainly, if you're talking about, you know, per Ross Hunt's analysis, the lopsided vote, independent vote for the Democratic candidate,
yeah,
which can be interpreted a lot of different ways. And so I'm not, you know, I see that part of the analysis.
Right.
I think it's harder to know from where I'm sitting anyway,
yeah,
what the other part of that we're always talking about here, the ground up piece.
Yeah.
And in that sense, you do want to think, you have to think a little bit about the profile and of the candidates, where Remit was a certain type of candidate,
yeah,
that moderate, and I would say some of these, we were talking about this offline today,
yeah,
some of the older Democrats in the state, Wimmitt was an ideal kind of candidate for the old school Democrats whose argument is we need moderate, more approachable candidates that come from a different sector of the party than the progressive wing of the party.
Yeah.
Bottom line. And on the other hand, the Republican was, as we were sketching earlier, which is why I wanted to get that on the table, a certain, you know, a very clearly identifiable model of Republican.
Yeah.
You know, very ideological, very invested in the ideological fights in the school boards, right, which are very much cultural politics. Mm-hmm. And so there is a, you know, there's a local dynamic to this.
Yeah.
And we're spinning our wheels about this in almost every podcast in terms of, you know, and this, you know, and I keep switching back and forth in terms of the side I'm on, as I've said on here. I mean, I started very much on the, let's not forget the bottom up dynamics, particularly in these limited, relatively limited local races with the extra layer of the special election. But I think the twain are meeting here.
Yeah, I mean, this is
what I would say.
This is a great example of overdetermination, right? Yeah. In the sense that, you know, I think what we're trying to suss out here is on the one, and the reason that it's interesting, I mean, just to back up one second when talking about specifically at the low bottom up, thinking about these candidates in particular, is this is something that was, has been an ongoing discussion when thinking about the primaries this year is, you know, to the extent that, you know, the effort on the Republican side is to be as close to Trump as possible in most cases, right? The question in some ways is whether that might produce some less than ideal candidates for Republicans, especially in case outside of the House, you know, when you start talking about like Congress and stuff where maybe you've made the districts a little bit less solid, right? And this was sort of the discussion that's been ongoing during redistricting. It's been ongoing now that, you know, if these candidates come out who are just, you know, in these competitive districts and they're just, you know, potentially unelectable, that just makes it for a tougher time. That's the local discussion here is whether this is an example of that. The Democrats recruited well, Republicans, you know, maybe not, you know, it's not in their control, but maybe not as well. And therefore, you know, that happened.
Well, I would probably stop there and say there's a lot to unpack in that. Did Republicans recruit well or not?
Right.
Because this, you know, this person was backed and maybe recruited is a strong word, but once the field was shaping up, it was pretty clear who the lieutenant governor wanted. Lieutenant governor has a lot at stake and has been active in investing in the composition of the body over which he presides. And I think from the perspective of the political position of the lieutenant governor, that's been a pretty successful approach.
Yes. Yes, very.
Given that we spent the last several years talking about how in the least polite, one of the less polite, I shouldn't say the least, but one of the less polite formulations, but that essentially the lieutenant governor is successfully brought the Republican caucus and the Republican caucus in the House to heel.
Right, in the Senate.
So, or in the Senate to heel. So.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think, you know, so on the one hand, you know,
Is that local or is that national, right? I mean,
Well, yeah. And then the other piece of it is say like, that could be, you know, so that could be true. Like that can all be existing there. And then the other piece of it is that we've got these big national trends, right? We've got Republican control of the federal government. We've got Republican control of the state government. And we've got, you know, we look in the state right now and we look at, you know, approval of the president. It's lower than it was back at the same time in 2018, right? We look at views of the economy. They are significantly worse now than at the same time in 2018. And when we look at these special elections around the country, Democrats have not had a hard time mobilizing their voters. And if nothing else, you can say Republicans had a hard time mobilizing their voters, I guess, in this election, like apparently we're half the electorate. I think part of this is to say this is all pushing in the same direction, which it gives Democrats, you know, an advantage in the space. I think the thing that's sort of so notable about this, and again, I'm the first to say let's not overinterpret special elections. And I don't want to overinterpret this one. I think actually this piece of data, this data point to me is less weighty or important than the others I just mentioned about, you know, broader economic attitude towards the president of the party. Those are much bigger factors, I think, right now. However, it's hard to dismiss this given the nature of the swing.
Right.
You know, if you went to a plus 17 to like a plus 2 Democrat, just eked it out, you'd say, okay, well, you know, yeah, you know, national conditions, whatever, the candidates weren't perfect. But when you go from plus 17 to minus 14, even it's pretty wild.
Even with the caveat of the special election and all that. And I guess what I would, the way I would express that, or what I would say that, is to say, if you look at this election, whatever, and you look at it in the context of the other handful of special elections that the Democrats have won.
Yeah.
And they've won most of them.
Yeah.
Something's, all those big public opinion measures you're talking about are being expressed here.
Exactly.
Particularly when you look at that as a national pattern. But, and I don't know enough of the other cases.
Well, and I think the challenge in bringing it back locally here to Texas is when you have something that's overdetermined like that, what it means is that, and I think you're seeing this in the aftermath, is it allows for a lot of interpretations, right? So some people can say, well, you know, we can dismiss this because that was a bad candidate. Or some people can say, well, no, you know, it was just that, like, they weren't campaign, like, there was the campaign strategy wasn't good. They should have been doing this, right? Or we didn't put money in soon enough. Or it can be, hey, you know.
Or there was somebody else in the state in the race that.
Right.
Or that was sort of what was being floated by, you know, the Patrick Consulting corner in on social media.
Right. And then, but then, you know, like you'll see, and we'll get to this in sort of story three here. And then there's another version that says, hey, look, guys, if we nominate candidates who, you know, are kind of way too far out there in districts that aren't going to support them, we're going to lose. And so we need to look at our candidates a little bit more, you know, closely. And obviously that's going to talk, it's going to lead us to another discussion later. But that's, again, an interpretation that's sort of allowed by the fact that,
right,
you know, and it, everything's pushing in this similar direction.
And by way of transition, that's the, you know, one of the political observations about this is that this becomes, by virtue of the substance itself, but also recency bias, maybe a little bit, a big display in the ongoing debate that you alluded to within the Republican Party about the kind of candidates that need to be recruited right now.
Right.
It should be recruited and should be supported in this political environment and at this point in the cycle, given expectations about a looming Democratic advantage,
right,
which this feeds the narrative of. So let's talk about Tallarico. Let's go on to the next one and talk about
it. Can I say one more thing about this?
Sure.
I'm sorry. I know you're going to push us forward because we have a lot to do. I just want to point out to other people who don't listen, just remember, and you said this at the beginning, but I want to make sure it's clear. Fort Worth has been kind of the bellwether county in the state.
Yeah.
So it's not as though this is not like, you know, we're not in the panhandle, we're not in Austin. And so that's another reason that I think there's so much attention to this outcome, because in addition to the fact that it's an overwhelming Republican district, it's in a part of the state that's considered, you know, pretty swingy, you know, but competitive. And this wasn't really competitive in the end.
Right. I mean, this district was drawn to account for that swinginess.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So we don't want to confuse this with all of Tarrant County or particularly what's been going on in Fort
Worth. But I do want to point out that, like, the region of the state that it's in is a more competitive region, which is actually meaningful.
Right.
Okay. Sorry.
So let's pivot to Tallarico Allred and Tallarico Allred Crockett dust up, although the core of it seems to be a Tallarico Allred dust up, and to your theory of the case, which we'll get to, and its ripples in the Senate primary on the Democratic side. So, you know, quick summary, this all blew up when an influencer I frankly had never heard of, Morgan Thompson, who's about a Dallas-based political
influencer
is, you know, the word I keep coming across, I don't know, posted a TikTok video that detailed a private conversation she had had with Tallarico last month or a while ago, actually. It was earlier on.
Right.
And the comment was that Thompson alleges that Tallarico told her he had signed up, quote unquote, signed up to run against a mediocre black man, unquote, referring obviously to Colin Allred, but was now instead facing a quote unquote formidable, intelligent black woman, referring to Jasmine Crockett. And now there's no recorded version of this conversation.
Right.
It's a TikTok video. I've no reason to either, you know, accept nor reject Morgan Thompson's account of this based on any knowledge, but we have to say there's no real evidence here other than what in court we would call hearsay.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for doing that for me. I appreciate
it.
We can move
okay.
On.
So, now we'll talk about everybody's response, but the response that really catalyzed a lot of this was from Colin Allred. Now Allred released a scathing, if to my mind, a little tonally odd video response, but there's a real Rorschach here. So we've got tape of that. Let's hear an excerpt of the most of the All Red response. So let's roll that tape.
I understand that James Tallarico had the temerity and the audacity to say to a black woman that he had signed up to run against a mediocre black man, meaning me, not a formidable, intelligent black woman, meaning Jasmine Crockett. Let me just break this down into a few segments here. First of all, let me just give you some free advice, James. If you want to compliment black women, just do it. Just do it. Don't do it while also tearing down a black man, okay? We've seen that play before. We're sick and tired of it. We're tired of folks using praise for black women to mask criticism for black men. That's not good for our community. It's not good. It just, it doesn't work, and we know what you're doing, okay? So if you, next time you want to praise a black woman, just do that. Leave black men out of it. Just leave a lot of things out of it. Second of all, did you ever have a coach or somebody, you know, a leader in your life tell you that when you make an accusation, you often have a bit of confession in it? Maybe you use the word mediocre because there was something creeping into your mind about yourself. Because I know you're not talking about somebody who's been better at three things than you've ever been at one. You are not saving religion for the Democratic Party or the left. We already had Senator Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock for that. We don't need you. You're not saying anything unique. You're just saying it looking like you do. Okay?
Whoa, somebody's mad.
Oof.
Yeah, that's a...
And we talked about the... I would... If you're interested and you've read about this but haven't seen the clip, I think you kind of have to see the clip to really digest fully what's going on there a little bit. Now... We'll unpack that a little bit more, but Tallarico's campaign characterized the allegation as a mischaracterization of a conversation that they did have. And I think that, you know, we can unpack that a little bit more. We'll just say that Tallarico admitted that he had used the word mediocre in proximity to Colin Allred, but that he was referring specifically to Allred's 2024 campaign strategy rather than him personally or this race or his race specifically. Right. For her part, Jasmine Crockett's campaign defended Allred's record. Of course, said there was nothing mediocre about Colin Allred, quote unquote. She noted that she also noted she had never personally heard Tallarico make racial remarks, but praised Allred for standing up against what she called demeaning rhetoric. Right. So where do we start with this? There are so many dimensions to this and a lot of things going on. Let's start with this morning you were talking about how tactically you were speculating on how this plays in the Texas 33 race.
32, where, I think it's 32.
Where Allred has landed.
Yeah.
And, you know, after getting out of the Senate race and then his district, you know, original district was redrawn as part of the map redrawing. And so now he and Julie Johnson are in the same district.
Right. And that's the race that he moved into when he got out of the Senate race on the Monday of the filing deadline when Crockett got in.
Right.
Which is my understanding, much to the surprise of Johnson. So, yeah, I mean, okay. This is tricky, as you say. You know, there are a lot of dimensions to work out here. But if we just sort of, I'm just going to start with just the pure politics of this.
Right.
You know, which is to say, that, you know, Allred tried to clear the Senate field by announcing immediately that he was running again for the Senate after failing, right?
Yep.
Against Ted Cruz. Ultimately didn't work. You know, I mean, just clearly didn't work. And so, you know, he jumps into this House race, as he says, to sort of reclaim his old House seat. Well, there's an incumbent. I mean, now you're running against an incumbent Democrat. You're not the incumbent. And so now what, right? Well, you know, we're looking at him. It's like, that's a district that's majority non-white. I mean, very, very much majority non-white. And in some ways, if nothing else, you know, in both races, in both the Senate primary and now in his own primary, it really brings, you know, race kind of to the forefront of this. You've got a black man against a white woman in a majority non-white district. You have a black woman against a white man in a majority non-white party primary statewide. And now we're talking about race in a way that, you know, we weren't really talking about at all before. And while I think, you know, and this is, I'll pass this, at least
not on the surface.
Let me pass this hot potato back to you, you know, and where I think that probably, you know, is going to benefit, might benefit Allred in his local primary. I'm not sure what it does at the statewide level for Democrats at this point, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a that's a good summary of that and of the game right in front of all red right now.
Right.
I think there's so many cross currents here that are very complicated and everybody's being relatively careful. I mean, just to be honest, you know, we both sort of noticed that the Houston Chronicle ran an op-ed piece, I think went up yesterday, whereas we're recording Thursday morning. You know, with the headline, it was the effect of, hey, let's face it, Colin Allred was a mediocre candidate.
Yeah.
And so there is this dynamic at work here where Jasmine Crockett did essentially knock Allred out of this race.
Right.
Because she was a more dynamic candidate.
Right.
And went in, you know, our polling, this is where our polling is sort of helpful.
Yeah. Right?
We talked about there wasn't a lot of polling at play here, but that, you know, essentially Crockett's numbers were better than Allred's among Democrats.
Yeah.
Partially as a result of, you know, as a result of a lot of different things.
Yeah.
But that certainly he had decent name recognition as a result of having run and lost in the last cycle against Ted Cruz. But he was, his candidacy was vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it was vulnerable, frankly, from right in the direction that Crockett came from.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a kind of, there is a tension here between this lack of clarity on exactly what was said.
Right.
And the racial language and identifiers that were used in there and the general sense that this race would not look like, would not have the configuration it has right now. Mm-hmm. If people thought Colin Allred had done a great job in the last cycle.
Yeah, Tallarico would not have gotten the race had Colin Allred, you know, cleared the field.
I think that's very likely, that Colin Allred could not clear the field.
Right.
So I think in a more practical view, and you and I were talking about this morning, we can also add the degree to which the Crockett campaign's response was constructed.
Notably.
As, you know, indicative of what some of the parameters and some of the boundaries of this likely are, mm-hmm. of this discussion and this development are going to be going forward.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, I think in the short term, this is a good break for the Crockett campaign.
Yeah.
In the immediate term, to the extent that polling has shown Tallarico doing what he needs to do,
right,
in terms of raising his name recognition, getting out there more, building a candidacy for, you know, to use a very general term.
Yeah.
And there's not been a lot of negative blowback.
No.
I mean, there have been people that are, I would say, in the borderline advocacy press, without naming names, who are kind of clearly leaning towards Crockett's candidacy, that have been happy to highlight what the limitations or the lack of definition of a Tallarico campaign are. But aside from that very small kind of, you know, nipping at the heels in some corners of social media, for the most part, Tallarico's had a pretty good run for the last month or so. And this is definitely an obstacle in that. This is not what the Tallarico campaign wants to be dealing with.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, if there has been any criticism of the Tallarico campaign coming from sort of the whatever pro-Crockett forces exist, it's been the fact that he's doing so poorly compared to her amongst African Americans in Texas in the polling that does exist. Here's where the challenge comes in, you know, just in terms of just like brass political tacks, right? Yeah. Which is that, you know, Texas isn't Georgia. And the African-American share of the population, the electorate, is just not really any bigger here than it is, you know, in the country as a whole. And so it's not necessarily this prime moving voting block. Now, look, no Democrat is going to be competitive without the vast, you know, overwhelming support of the African-American voters in Texas. And everybody knows that that's not a surprise here. But it's also the case that, you know, I'm not sure that this fundamentally shifts some of the dynamics that were already kind of taking place within this race. The question in some ways is more so, and the more pregnant question that I don't know if we're going to deal with today is kind of like, what happens after this? So if Crockett's the nominee, or if he's the nominee, I mean, does the fact that you've got, you know, a potential congressional candidate sitting there basically calling him a racist in a pretty heated video, like, is that a problem later? You know, we'll see. I mean, that's kind of the don't know. But also, you know, we've talked about this. It's no less complicated for Crockett. Right. I mean, you know, and as I said, you know, for a candidate who's sort of been made her brand around being, you know, I would say, I'm trying to think what the right exact word here is. You know, we'll say incendiary maybe. And that could be used as positive or negatively. Right. But it's been an incendiary kind of style or whatever. You know, the very noted, very careful response to this, you know, indicates that this is not, you know, that easy for her.
Yeah, for somebody whose brand is temperamentally kind of hot.
Yeah.
This is a very cool response.
Right. I said, you know,
and measured.
And again, this is like, you know, drawing connections and, you know, I'll say a question that I have is like, I wonder whether there was communication between Allred's people and Crockett's people before this, you know, video came out or not.
Because one wonders.
One does wonder because it's not obvious to me in any way.
Me either. You know. And, you know, to your point about the longer term legs of this, I think that is to some degree the immediate question to me is, we're talking about this on Thursday. This really kind of blew up Monday or so, I guess, Sunday, Monday.
Yeah.
You know, how much longer are we talking about this? How much more of a half-life does this have in the campaign? Obviously, the Tallarico campaign has no interest in this going on, but that's where the Crockett response and what all, you know, how Allred responds going forward. Because if Allred continues to raise this, it's going to, I think that has the potential to turn it into a negative for the Crockett campaign.
Yeah, I think
so. You know, right now it can be seen as a tactical win for the reasons I was talking about a minute ago. You don't really want your campaign defined by this, I don't think.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, I think, you know, we're going to get to this when we get to the next story, you know, in just a second here, but it is really remarkable. I mean, part of this, you know, again, is as much as, you know, you can find any number, you know, just Google search singular moment or times, you know, unprecedented, and you'll find a million articles about all this. And then some of the stuff is really normal in some sense, which is, you know, the campaigns are really ramping up now. Oh, we're going to start criticizing each other. Oh, we're going to be a little, like, now we're going to start to try to make distinctions between each other. You know, the debate that the Tallarico and Crockett held, you know, last month, that was, you know, very pleasant. You know, maybe that's the end of that, which is, in some ways, that's politics, right? Now it's time to start making distinctions. And, you know, maybe this isn't the one that either one of them would have chosen, but now this is something that they're going to have to deal with. And it's easy. Like, do they want this to be the thing that they're going to keep? I don't think so. I don't think it benefits either of them really in the long run, but that, again, as you said, there's a third party in this.
Right. And I think in a lot of ways, there's two wild cards, just the third party, the Allred factor.
Yeah.
And then there's, this sounds so cliched, but there is the media environment factor here, but that I think matters in the sense that, to go back to where we started a little bit, here you have this person, social media influencer apparently, saying, recounting the story of which there is no empirical confirmation.
Right.
In which the two parties thus far that we know of that were involved have very different accounts.
Yeah.
And yet it's taken off to some degree. And so what happens on that front? Who's incentivized to keep this story alive? I kind of think it's not going to have a lot of legs. That's a totally speculative gut feeling, because there aren't enough people with an incentive to keep it too prominent, given the shaky foundation of what's actually there.
Right. As you went, the main person would be Allred, which honestly, I don't think it's going to help him in the long run. I think he's gotten what he's gotten out of this for his race. And I think, you know, be wise.
Yeah. We were also talking about this earlier. I mean, when is the last time you really had heard from Colin Allred very much?
Well, we'll move on. And I mean, I feel like I have to say this, but it is kind of like, you know, I imagine there are a lot of Democrats out there, and I've heard from a number of them saying, like, hey, where was this guy?
Right.
You know, in some way, this is sort of so kind of off-brand for him in some ways to sort of be out there and to be a little bit, you know, more forceful in what he was saying. And, you know, it's sort of like, oh, this is an interesting version of this candidate that we've never seen.
Yeah.
You know, at least not at the statewide level. And so it's sort of an interesting that the fire gets turned inward, you know, but that's also, you know, that's where we are right now. And also that's also something we've been talking about a lot, which is, you know, the Democratic Party is, you know, as much as the Republican Party is so clearly led, the Democratic Party is so clearly unled. And so there's a lot of room here to kind of have these fights out in some ways. And we haven't had a bunch of them, but right. We'll probably be having some more. I mean,
yeah, and if we back up, this is the kind of stuff that happens in a party primary.
Oh yeah.
And sometimes it has legs, and sometimes at this point people are wagging their fingers going, they're going to use this against us in the general. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any research. It's an interesting empirical question.
Yeah.
You could probably come up with at least anecdotal examples on both sides where we thought this was going to be a big deal and we never heard anything about it again.
Mm-hmm.
And yep, that people brought that back. They rolled the tape, et cetera. Right. And there is a certain primary politics as usual element to this that I think we should all keep our eye on.
Coalitional politics, man.
Right. I mean, and it's in a lot of people's interest to go, aha, there they are. They're at it again. And that goes for both sides by way of transition.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, in the sense that this is what happens during a primary.
Right.
People are fighting hard to win a nomination. And when it's a U.S. Senate seat, it's a pretty big damn prize.
Yeah. And then to your point, I mean, like a lot of the arguments come down to, you know, there are coalitions within the parties and a lot of the discussion, because we're all D's or we're all R's or whatever. So it becomes like, who is going to represent your interest? In this case, yours, some group is part of the coalition better. And if you're at the union hall or if you're at the church or if you're at whatever, the bar, they're different groups. And you're going to be kind of like cultivating those groups in different ways. This is, you know, this
and
is
even
given on.
That, in a lot of cases, I mean, some cases there are clear distinctions. You know, in this case, policy-wise, ideology-wise, I don't think the distinctions between, I mean, I'm not saying they're exactly the same, and we could go down issue by issue, and maybe at some point we'll do that, but it's not as if there is this stark policy or ideological contrast between these two candidates.
No, not on the issues that most of the voters, especially in the Democratic primary, are going to pay attention to or care about.
I think that's right.
Right.
So on the other side, to connect back to where we started a little bit, in the wake of all the Republican hand-wringing over the SD9 election, President Trump, once again, very conveniently and helpfully, provided the umpteenth example of how his presence hovers over state politics, hovers over everything.
Right.
You know, a recurring theme in the pod. So let's just start with, we do have tape of this. So let's start with what the president said when he was asked about his endorsement in the Texas GOP Senate race on Sunday in a press gaggle at Mar-a-Lago. So let's roll that clip.
To endorse in that Senate race, has your mind
Which
changed
Senate
at all?
Race?
In Texas, the GOP primary.
I'm giving it very serious thought. You know, my problem is I'm friendly with all of them. Those are the hard ones. I like all of them. All three. But you'll be seeing soon.
Okay.
They say whoever I endorse wins. That's probably right.
Well, I love that. The last part's pretty great.
Yeah, that is pretty great.
I should do this because it's, you know, it's going to matter.
Right.
And I'll give him this. He's probably right.
Well, you know, I mean, I can honestly, and again, we're going to make tenuous connections here, but you can hear that was something he heard on the phone from somebody else after that. I mean, to me, I want to make the connection so badly, and it's and I just know that, you know, like that's a like you can hear someone on the phone with him after that SC9 set loss, and no, we spent a ton of money. No, we really tried. I mean, honestly, we need to make sure we have the right candidate in the Senate race.
Okay? Well, and your
choice matters here.
And I can't help but note that. In an earlier question, in another context, somebody asked him about it. And he was like, "Yeah, I don't know anything about it."
Yeah,
about SD9,
right?
And he had, of course, handed out endorsement to.
He did, and his if not
to
him,
the Republican candidate.
And to be fair to him, as any other politician with social media presence, whatever his. Entities were producing, mobilizing messages in the final 48 hours on his behalf or on his own or whatever. So they were, you know, the team was involved in this race.
Yeah. And if you're seeing the TV ads that we keep talking about periodically in here, Donald Trump looms large in most, if not all of these Republican primary campaigns. So He says he probably will.
Yeah.
We'll see if he will. How are you thinking about what that decision might be and how we might know?
What do I think the decision might be?
Yeah. I mean, does he endorse or not? I mean, if he endorses who he decides to endorse, I mean, we were talking about the probability markets and, you know, I looked at some rando betting market, which had a 60 something chance that he would endorse Cornyn. I mean, the vibe seems to be if he endorses at this point, it will be Cornyn.
Yeah, that's my expectation. I mean, there's a lot of things going on here, right? I mean, first of all, you know, you look at sort of where the two candidates are in fundraising, and I think this is meaningful and important, right? So Cornyn ended the year with $15 million in his campaign accounts he controls. There's a super PAC that's supporting him that reported $5 million cash on hand at the end of the year. So a little math, that's $20 million. It's a lot, right? Paxton's campaign reported $3.7 million cash on hand at the end of the year, and then the super PAC supporting him had 2.8, so that's 6.5. And a lot of people are noting right now that a lot of the spending that you normally see associated around PACs is just not going on. Now, I pointed out to a lot of people, it's like, you know, even if Paxton is good friends with numerous donors in the Republican, you know, megaverse of donors, you know, if you have interest before the federal government, going after incumbent leadership members is not a really good place to put yourself, even if you think you're going to win. I mean,
and there are pre-existing relationships with Cornyn, based on his longevity and the kind of representative and the kind of senator he's been.
Well, and I think that's part of the point too here. And I've said this before. I'll say just a reminder. You know, Cornyn has always been raising money, or at least for the last, you know, 20 plus almost 30 years under the federal rules that limit the way the campaign contributions can come in. This is Paxton's first go around at this, which is why, you know, his donor network can't be leveraged in the same way it can at the state level. But also, Cornyn's network is just bigger, right? He's been a fundraiser for the party. I mean, he's fundraised for other candidates and distributed money throughout the country. And so you're seeing that here. And I only bring that up because it's not so much to say that that's what matters, I think. But I think when Republicans are looking at the cost calculations right now of what it would take to pay for an expensive Senate race in Texas, you know, the one thing about Cornyn is he can probably take care of himself for the most part. I think he can raise most of his money. He may call on the RNC here and there. He's going to, you know, say we need.
Well,
stuff.
It's the Senate entity that Thune is in charge of.
Yeah. Right, and he's got good relations there. I mean, and I would say the thing I was noticing, you know, there's a big fundraising advantage for the RNC over the DNC. It's about $100 million, I think. But the thing is, it costs about $100 million to run in Texas, you know. Yeah. And so I think one of the concerns here is that if candidate quality matters, if Paxton is potentially too ideologically extreme, or if he's too damaged by a lot of the scandals that he's had over time, I think the Republicans in leadership, both at the, you know, at the federal level, even in the state, are asking themselves, how much is it going to cost to keep this seat? And I think if you're Trump, one of the things you're thinking to yourself is, do I want to be the Republican president who oversees a Republican loss of a Texas Senate seat? You know, really the first loss of any Texas statewide election in 30 years. And the answer is no. Now, does that mean he endorses? No, but you can see why he's thinking about it. And you can see why people want him thinking about it.
And why he would take a, you know, a kind of risk-sensitive position towards it. And, you know, there are a lot of channels to consider here.
Yeah.
And as I think about this, and you know, we know that there's connective tissue between Texas and Texas Republicans and what is going on in the Trump administration.
Right.
And one's always tempted to factor that in because of the track record that those relationships matter.
Yeah.
Well, you've got former, or they're not even former, you've got people that are associated with Trump's campaign and political apparatus. And I've said this on the podcast, I beat the dead horse on the podcast, but worth repeating in this contest, Chris LaCivita, Trump's pollster Tony Fabrizio, both hired by the Cornyn campaign. I have no idea how central they are to the campaign, but they are on the payroll. And these are going to be voices that have inroads into the Trump White House. Whether they're talking to Trump every day, they are talking to people around Trump. And that also coexists with other elected officials, you know, Dan Patrick and his political consulting team have ties. Those people have ties into the Trump administration. So there are signals being sent in all likelihood here. And if Trump is making this that what appears to be a pivot in terms of having withheld his endorsement so far. Now, look, it could have very well just been the plan all along that he was going to wait. And there was, I would believe that, then they were going to wait and see how this shaped up.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned risk. You know, and the first thing I think, I mean, the riskier move for Trump is to endorse Cornyn, I think. I mean, you know, based on, you know, what we know about the Republican electorate, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it feels that way to me in terms of if he wants to be the kingmaker. I think, you know, everybody has kind of considered, Cornyn to be a little bit under, you know, say under the gun here. And so the idea is this enough? But I mean, to your point about making these connections, I mean, I'm looking at, you know, how many Republican votes turned out in that SD9 race, and you're talking about 40,000 votes. And if they really did spend about, you know, $10 million or so to get 40,000 Republicans out, and you're Dan Patrick, who's very aware of this for all the reasons we've already talked about, and Dan Patrick, who has gotten Donald Trump no less than to call in to the Texas legislature from time to time, like the idea that that's not being communicated, like how ineffective the money was here. Yeah. It's like, I just can't imagine those communications are going up the chain. Like,
right. Well, I think, I guess the way that I would play out that scenario is if I'm the pro Cornyn forces and I'm talking to Trump or Susie Wiles or
whoever,
Trump world in DC, mm-hmm. trying to angle towards an endorsement for Cornyn, and I'm trying to talk about the risk proposition, I think the argument that I would make would be, yes, there is some risk here because for all the reasons that we could lay out,
mm-hmm.
you know, Paxson is very popular with, you know, probably more popular. We know he's viewed more favorably, all things being equal, than Cornyn among Republican primary voters. Cornyn is behind. And yes, you could be embarrassed if you endorse Cornyn and Paxton still wins.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if that is the case, you will also not only be embarrassed, but you will lose a vote in the Senate.
Right.
And you can play on Trump's anxiety that I think is clearly evident, mm-hmm. or fear, whatever you want to call it, or, you know, if you want to be as neutral as possible. His desire to avoid losing both houses of Congress,
mm-hmm.
when in all likelihood, I suspect that if people are telling him the truth, they are telling him odds are we're going to lose the House.
Yeah.
And so if I was the Cornyn people, I would be saying the Senate is even more important than ever now, and you're going to have to take on a little risk here, because if Paxton is the nominee, Paxton is more likely to lose than Cornyn.
Yep.
In the general election.
And that's a fact. I mean, I think we can say that. I mean, you know, I think
so that would be the argument I would make in terms of this risk calculation. You know, you need to bear this risk now, which is smaller than the risk, which will be much larger in the end, the negative outcome much larger in the general election if Ken Paxton is the nominee.
Can I give you some rank speculation now?
Please.
So what I think is probably going to happen, or what I think we're waiting for, what I think they're waiting for in making a decision, is we know that the Cornyn campaign and his allies are about to dump a ton of money. They've made that very clear on this race. And as you point out, in some ways, I should pause for 1 second. This is why we've been saying all along, you got to wait to start sort of seeing what voters think, because if Cornyn spends, you know, $50 million or something trying to reach Republican primary voters over the next 2 weeks, you know, they're going to hear from him. And I'm not saying they're all going to change their mind, but some of them are. Some of them aren't. But the idea that we can know what this contest was going to look like, you know, 6 months ago is like, you know, hold your horses here, because we got a lot right. going on, right? And like, think about all that we're talking about right now. Okay. So
was completely incalculable in October.
Exactly. Even in October.
Let alone June.
Right. Anyways, but we know that Cornyn's about to spend a ton of money. His ally groups are about to spend a ton of money. I would suspect that this is kind of a show me, you know, the moment here, which is they spend this money, they start carpet bombing Paxton, they do some polling. If they can show that he's making progress and Trump feels like he can push him over,
yeah,
then I think Trump endorses. If not, I think he sits back and lets the chips
fall. Well, and I think in some ways Trump shows his hand there.
Yeah.
In that's the appeal.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. President, this is very close. You can make the difference.
Right.
And this is how, going in this direction, this is the difference you want to make in order to defend your position,
mm-hmm.
and avoid a Democratic Senate that will convict you if there is an impeachment in a Democratic House.
Yes. Right.
So.
Yeah.
You know, and will you know, start issuing, you know, doing their best to block your legislation.
Well, I'll just drop this in real quick. I mean, one of the people were pointing out that, you know, one of the, you know, things that falls out of the Clintons being willing to testify in front of Congress over Epstein is that it sets the precedent that you can call in former presidents, you can call in their families, and you can have them testify over these kinds of issues. And
yeah.
There's 11 of like nine Democrats who like weren't even like were in diapers when Clinton was in
president. That's one of those really strange, like, oh, and by the way.
Yeah. By the way,
this thing too, and more consequential than, you know, for the reasons you're talking about than one might have thought.
Yeah.
So I think in a way we connected that all at the end anyways.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think it's connected.
You know, I think we drew enough connections there to call it a day. So
when they do this on video, eventually they'll see us in the background with all the strings and everything, like Homeland. We're making all those.
Oh, right. There you go. Yes. Yes, we will be like bipolar Carrie Matheson, charting out all the connections.
I've got a lot of tinfoil.
That's good. That's good. Well, she, you know, Carrie got to the bottom a lot of stuff that people thought was crazy.
She was a bad CIA agent. I'm just going to tell you.
So a little Homeland reference to end the podcast. Okay. Josh, thanks for being here. That was fun.
Yes.
As always, thanks again to our excellent production team here in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks to all of you for listening. You can find supporting data and much more that I think you would find useful at our website. That's texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So check that out, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project and the Project 2021 Development Studio at the University of Texas at Austin.